Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, December 13th, and our friend Alex Craner is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you, Nima. Good to be with you, and greetings to your viewers and listeners.
Let's get started, Alex, with the situation in Syria. When you look at Syria right now, we have these jihadists, takfiris. They're trying to make a government, and Israel just has bombed all over Israel. They have destroyed everything in Israel. The United States and Turkey are fighting each other with Kurds. And how do you see the situation in Syria and the way that Iran and Russia are witnessing it and are thinking about it?
In the short term, Nima, the situation is absolutely dismal. In the long term, we'll have to find out. I suspect that a lot of what we think we know about the events on the ground will prove inaccurate, you know, because there's a lot of psyops, there's a lot of misinformation. People in the region, I think, are generally disorientated as to the day-to-day events. You know, we have these supposedly reformed jihadi head choppers who are now giving signals about tolerance and inclusivity, while at the same time their units are slaughtering and executing Christians and former Syrian army soldiers. So it's just looking awful. And then the proxy conflict between Turkey and the United States, I wonder what's going to come out of that. But I think that in general, looking longer term, I know it's hard to say this, but I tend to be a little bit more optimistic as to the future because I, you know, the news we had on Sunday, which is now, 5 days ago, were absolutely spectacular. This simply does not happen. You know, a whole country, a whole government just folded like a house of cards in the space of 11 days. I've never heard of something like this happening because the Syrian army, they numbered about 270,000 troops. The HTS, these new and improved Al-Nusra Front and their friends and allies, they invaded Syria with a force of between 20 and 30,000 troops. So let's call them 30,000. So the narrative at the moment is that they were the best armed and best equipped insurgency ever in the history of the universe and whatever. But they were armed with relatively light weapons. They came in on pickup trucks and improvised armored vehicles. So not even real armored vehicles, tanks, things you would need. Their air cover was drones run by Ukrainian technicians. So, you know, okay, but not exactly helicopters and air force. And so, you know, when an invading force attacks, they would have to outnumber the defending force by at least 3-1 to have a chance to overcome the resistance. The Syrian army had 8 years, you know, since the time they lifted the siege of Aleppo, which was December 2016, until now, they had full 8 years to regroup and rearm and to build reinforcements and to prepare their defenses. The attack from Idlib was not a surprise. It was well understood that this was coming. Iranian intelligence gave the Syrians specific warnings about this 2 months before it happened. And I understand that even 6 months before it happened, it was expected. Now we have other explanations that the Syrian soldiers were so poorly paid and their commanders were corrupt. And, you know, when they were under attack, they just, you know, changed their clothes to civilians and they ran away. Well, you know, I can't accept that story. It's inconceivable to me because I was a soldier during wartime in Croatia, and you know, our commanders were who they were. My monthly salary was good enough to pay 4 beers out in the city. But I guarantee you that there wasn't any discussions among us. Are we paid enough to defend our country? You know, is this worth our trouble? Or maybe we should all just disband and go home. That doesn't happen. You know, you're in a total institution. You have commanders. You don't just disregard your orders and do what you think is best for you. And so I would understand and accept is if some units here or there withdrew, demobilized themselves, failed to defend, even went over to the other side. That can happen in war. But that the whole army of 270,000 troops just disintegrates in the space of 11 days, that cannot happen. That's just, you know, that to me is like claiming that office fires brought down steel frame buildings. It just doesn't happen. And in fact, you know, I listened to Vanessa Beely's interview, which I think was published just yesterday. And she said that there were some reports that the orders were coming from, you know, top level command to demobilize and disband. So, you know, that explains it. And if that's what happened, then we have to ask, where did these orders come from? Why were they given? And what was the strategy? What was the, you know, because this is the same Syrian army, the same Syria, the same Bashar al-Assad in command, who defended Syria for 4 long years between 2011 and 2015 against a concerted attack against, you know, ISIS and al-Nusra and Khorasan and al-Qaeda and all the other groups against the UK, the US, and all the Arab states, a concerted attack. And they resisted for 4 long years before the Russians finally came to their rescue. So to say that, you know, the soldiers are not paid so well, they're not trained so well, that the commanders are corrupt and whatnot, it's not a convincing explanation. So I would go with the guess that there was an order given, and then, you know, we have to explain why this order was given. And today we know that Bashar al-Assad was in Moscow on the 28th and 29th November. He didn't go there on tourism trip. He didn't go there to have a coffee with Vladimir Putin. He went there to discuss something important, but we don't know what that was. My guess would be that the decision was made to just let the invading forces in. And why this might have been done, I would speculate, but I think I won't be far from guessing correctly, that rather than taking, the attack was coming. The endeavors to destabilize and regime change Syria were in the works anyway. You know, there was pressure being put on Bashar al-Assad to sever his ties with Iran. He was being seduced into doing something like this even by the Arab states, who were intermediating with the Western powers, United States in particular, that, you know, if they severed ties with Iran, that they would be able to normalize relations with the West, that there would be an ease of sanctions and all these things that might have induced Bashar al-Assad to give up on the axis of resistance and to throw his lot with the Western powers and with the Arab states. And so we have reports that this was indeed going on. The Iranians knew about it. The Russians knew about it. The Turks learned about it as well, as we know now. And so, you know, something was going to happen anyway. So I think that the decision was made not to go frontal against Israel, against the insurgency from Idlib, but to let them in. And the reason why this decision might have been made is because by letting them in, you know, instead of being concentrated force one against the other, instead of letting them in this, instead of doing this, if you let them in, then these 30-odd thousand troops are now dispersed all throughout Syria, which is a very large territory. And so now they're easy to pick off if you want to apply the attrition warfare against them. Same thing with Israel. You know, Israel just walked in and took over another chunk of Syrian Golan Heights. The initial gloom and doom reports that the land bridge now between Iran and Hezbollah has been severed, and this is the strategic defeat of the axis of resistance, I don't think those are very realistic either, because let's remember that all these jihadis, most of them are mercenaries, right? They don't have permanent loyalties. They will go to the highest bidder. Will they police this land bridge and make sure that it's hermetically closed and that nothing goes between Iran and Hezbollah? That's very unlikely. You know, I think that if you cut them in, you give them a couple of thousand bucks, they will let anything pass. I mean, you know, if anything, this region is the homeland of smuggling. So the traffic will continue in one way or another. Will the Israelis be able to police it? Probably only partly, and probably only through the air. If they try to police it with boots on the ground, they're going to be a magnet for insurgency attacks. So they're going to take heavy casualties. So I think that, you know, it was this illusory, brilliant victory that seems to have fallen into the lap of the Western powers and Israel. But I think, you know, as I wrote in one of my articles recently, in war, the only place you walk into this easily is a trap. And I don't know exactly what the nature of this trap is, but I think that we can maybe make the outlines of it if we take a broader strategic picture of the event. And to do that, I would you know, take a 30,000 feet view of the situation. And first of all, we have to realize that the war being fought in Ukraine and the war being fought in the Middle East are two battles of the same conflict. On 29th November in Sana'a, Vladimir Putin made a very significant statement with regards to the winding down of the war in Ukraine. And what he said is, warning the Western powers, is that Russia is not interested in a ceasefire. They're not interested in a temporary freeze of the conflict to allow, you know, to allow the West to regroup and rearm and the Ukrainians to reinforce their troops. Vladimir Putin wants a final resolution to this conflict. And now we have to ask ourselves, what would be the final resolution of this conflict? And I think it's pretty clear that the Russians, and it's not just the Russians, I think that they are on the same side here with the Iranians, with the Chinese, and probably increasingly with India and other powers in the region. They want an overhaul of the whole security architecture of the Eurasian continent. The old security architecture is basically the vestige of British geopolitics. And British geopolitics, to understand what that is, we have to go back to the theory about the geographic pivot of the world. In 1904, Halford Mackinder wrote the seminal paper titled The Geographic Pivot of the World, in which he hypothesized that the main vulnerability of the British Empire was that it was a maritime empire. So Britain was a sea power. But they expected that a more powerful empire would emerge as a land-based empire. And so after a long study of geography and history, Halford Mackinder came to the conclusion that the only area in the world which is optimally positioned to give rise to this new empire was what he termed the geographical pivot of history, the pivot power. And so this is the expanse of land between, let's say, it encompasses Ukraine, Russia, the Caucasus, Kazakhstan, and stretches out to Afghanistan. And so this he termed the pivot area. And he said that whatever power emerges on that in that part of the geography will become eventually an alternative, much more powerful empire. And they expected that this power would be Russia or an alliance of powers in that region. And so also what happened in 1904 was that the Russians introduced the Trans-Siberian Railway. So the British imperial cabal was alarmed about this because they thought that the introduction of the Trans-Siberian Railway would catalyze the development of this empire, and that it would be able to eventually overpower the maritime power of Great Britain. And so the way Mackinder proposed that they should prevent this empire from emerging is by surrounding it by an arc of crisis in this inner crescent. So there was the pivot area, and then south of it, there was this whole arc of that he called the inner crescent. And so by surrounding the pivot power with this arc of crisis everywhere, which at the time Mackinder was talking about France, Italy, Egypt, India, and Korea, he was proposing that they could always drag the pivot power into these quagmire wars, where the maritime powers could supply, you know, weapons, ammunition, materiel, troops, supplies to wage war against the pivot power, and that way always bleed it and always weaken it and prevent it from fully developing its economic and political and military potential. And so since 1904, you know, circumstances changed because Israel was created, Ukraine became an independent nation. There was a division between India and Pakistan, so that's another flashpoint there. And now Balochistan, Pakistan, that's another crisis point. Then, you know, Bangladesh was regime changed recently. So that's a crisis flashpoint, potentially with India, potentially with Myanmar. And then Koreas were split into South Korea and North Korea. So you have this arch of crisis where we see that there's a permanent warfare that going always somewhere there. And this is in the end how they collapsed the Soviet Union, because they drew it into the conflict in Afghanistan. And so the long-term strategy that Russia and China are driving right now is, I think, to bring this arc of crisis to a permanent peace. And so Ukraine is part of that, and we see that war drawing to a close. But the Middle East, Syria, and Israel are another part of this. So I think that they are going to, you know, rather than defending the regime of Bashar al-Assad, I think that what they want to do is completely destroy these forces of, you know, the terrorists, the separatists, and the Western proxies, including Israel, to bring them to a permanent peace. And I think that they probably judge that rather than going for a frontal conflict against these powers, it would be better to draw them in and then to destroy them through attrition. We can see from the war in Ukraine and from wars that Russia fought historically, that the Russians, unlike the Westerners, are not obsessed with maps and with the color of who controls what. And that's a little bit illusory because, you know, what are 30,000 jihadis really controlling, even if you paint all of Syria into green or yellow or whatever color they get? They don't really control much. And, you know, when Napoleon went to invade Russia with an overwhelming force, the Russians judged that they couldn't take it in a frontal war. So they let him in. They let him in all the way to Moscow. And then through attrition, they destroyed that force. And then we had Operation Barbarossa in 1941, which was the biggest invasion force ever assembled. It was between 3.5 and 4 million troops, not just Germans, but pretty much most of the European nations contributed to that invasion force. Again, the Russians knew that they couldn't beat them in a frontal clash, so they let them in and attrited them and destroyed them ultimately. So this takes time, and it's very painful and it's very bloody, but in the end, you destroy the enemy. So I suspect that this is what was decided, and this is why the Syrian command issued the order to disband, to fold, and to not fight this war. Obviously, you know, this would be a trap, so therefore it would be a secret strategy, so that the enemy would be taken by surprise, which means that you have to sacrifice, you have to make a certain sacrifice. You can't prepare your troops and your political leaders and the population weeks or months in advance that this is what's going to happen. You have to do it, you know, at a certain time and a certain moment. And it comes as a surprise to everybody. So it was a surprise to everybody. The jihadis themselves didn't expect this. The Turks didn't. The Americans didn't. The Israelis didn't. The Israeli intelligence thought that the whole affair was a suicide mission because you had these 30,000 jihadis attacking an army of 270,000 with reinforcement and with dug in their defensive positions. So this took everyone by surprise, and I suspect there must be a reason for that. So now I think there's a lot of talk about betrayal, about the Russians letting Syria go, betraying the axis of resistance, Iran taking a big strategic defeat and this and that. I think that we need to wait for dust to settle. And I think that when the dust settles, it'll become clear that the West and Israel just walked into a trap, and it's probably going to be the last quagmire for the Western Empire. This isn't really rocket science, because this is exactly how the CIA and Zbigniew Brzezinski brought down the Soviet Empire. They drew them into the quagmire in Afghanistan. And now the Western Empire entered the quagmire in Syria. And then, you know, for people who have difficulty seeing any silver lining in this, I would bring up the example of Chechnya. Because in the 1990s, Russia fought two Chechen wars, and they were horrible. They were absolutely destructive. The whole country was practically destroyed. Grozny looked like almost like Gaza today. But that ended soon after Putin came to power, and people won't recall, but in the summer of 2015, Times magazine, the journalist Simon Schuster went to Chechnya And he wrote a long report and a video report, which I don't know if it's still online. I think it was taken down. But basically what he said is that there are no signs of warfare in Grozny anymore. Children who are growing up there don't see any signs of war. And today Chechnya is much more prosperous than it has ever been in its long history. So it's a different approach to warfare. It's also a different approach to peace. And so I believe that with time, and it will probably take some years, as this arch of crisis is neutralized, which will be painful and it will take time, I think that we will get real permanent peace on the Eurasian continent. And I think that that vision is perhaps what makes sacrificing certain things today worth the price. So I hope that I'm right about this, but I think we will only know with time.
If we assume that the United States, together with Israel, they were winner of this conflict in Syria, as they trying to picture it in the West. Why has Israel bombed everything in Syria? This is a main question.
Bombed everything in Syria, and the Americans joined them. They allocated 4 B-52 bombers. I think they were panicked because I believe that their idea was that the jihadists are simply going to bleed Syrian Arab army dry and weaken it so much that then, the regime of Bashar al-Assad would ultimately fall after a long protracted bloody conflict with these HTS forces. And when they saw that these jihadists penetrated through Syria in 11 days, they were panicked because they thought that all of these military assets controlled by Syria up until that point are going to fall into their hands. They have no illusions that they can control these forces. They can control themselves. They're already fighting between one another over loot and control of territory and economic assets. And so I think that the reaction of the United States and Israel was sheer panic to make sure that they destroy all of these arsenals and all of these military assets so that they don't fall into the hands of the jihadis. And, for all those people who are celebrating this, brilliant victory that just kind of fell into their lap unexpectedly, let's remember the long-term expectancy out of these victories, because 20-some years ago, the Americans triumphantly walked into Kabul. Right? Same thing. Oh, what a brilliant victory. They took Kabul, they defeated the Taliban. And then 20 years and $4 trillion later, they handed Afghanistan back to the same Taliban and withdrew. And then the same thing in Iraq in 2003, they triumphantly walked into Baghdad. And now the U.S. forces are there, holed up in their military bases. They're completely sitting duck at the mercy of Iran and its proxies. And then the brilliant victory over Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. Part of that agenda was driven by France, by French President Nicolas Sarkozy, and their thinking was that this was going to help France secure their hold on their dependencies in North Africa and West Africa. Today, they practically have no dependencies left. They've been kicked out almost completely. They're being kicked out as we speak from Senegal and Chad. And then, the whole gambit in Ukraine backfired spectacularly. In 2014, they overthrew the democratically elected government. They installed their own proto-fascist junta there. They induced them, they coerced them to launch this bloody, atrocious, how do you call it, anti-terror operation in 2014. And now they're losing Ukraine. They're being completely defeated there. And then, you know, going back to Ukraine, I want to point out another thing. You know, when the events happened in 2014 and the, you know, the Kiev regime's attack on south and eastern Ukraine were really bloody. They killed many thousands of people, and something like 2 million got displaced as refugees. There were very, very bitter recriminations about this in Russia, and many people in Russia felt that Vladimir Putin had betrayed their Russian brothers and sisters in Ukraine. They never betrayed them. It's just that at that time, it was decided not to go to war against the West or against Ukraine, because for a variety of reasons, you know, there were other venues to explore, other options to exhaust, and other preparations made. You know, Russia was vulnerable to economic sanctions, to kind of being cutting off from SWIFT. It had weapons in development that were not ready to be deployed yet, and so on and so forth. So, you know, the Russians never betrayed Ukraine, but, you know, certain things happen in their due course, and they can't be done at the moment we would like for them to be done. You know, we all want the killing in Palestine to stop. We would all prefer for people of Syria to live in peace and prosperity. Unfortunately, I think that everything we're experiencing today are the vestiges of that, you know, British approach to geopolitics, where divide and rule was the recipe implemented everywhere, where borders were drawn in such a way that they could guarantee future conflicts. And I think that the remnants of this pathogenic geopolitics is what is being overhauled today, and it's going to take time, and it's going to be painful and difficult, but I think that the world is moving in that direction.
Alex, do you find Iran and Russia right now, if that was the plan in Syria, what would be the future of the relationship between Iran and Russia and the way that they're talking about it? We have this corridor from north to south, and by January 25th they're gonna have a new agreement, comprehensive agreement between Iran and Russia. So far, we haven't heard from China, because we know part of this conflict in Syria are these Uyghurs coming from China, but we haven't heard from them. How do you see what's going on between Iran, Russia, and China right now?
I think that the current events are only solidifying that alliance. I think that it's obvious that Russia needs Iran, and that Iran needs Russia. And we already know that under this new security architecture, and under SEO strategy of development, that China has designated Iran as the pivot of this regional security architecture. And I don't think that, you know, I don't think that the Chinese are going to change their mind about it. I think that that strategy makes very, very good sense. And I think that they're only going to be building on it. I think that all of these nations are still quite vulnerable. You know, we see that the Western powers are now in a panic to make sure they light up all the fuses before Donald Trump comes into office in January. You know, they canceled democracy in Romania. They're trying desperately to prevent the new government from taking office from taking power in Georgia. They've pushed Syria into chaos and disorder. They regime changed Bangladesh. And they tried to even orchestrate a military coup in South Korea. It's all related because, and it's all, the events in South Korea strangely overlapped with this sudden rhetoric about North Korean troops in Ukraine. And we see now that this rhetoric was used by South Korean President Yoon to, argue that, well, okay, if our rivals in North Korea are now helping Russia in Ukraine, then we should be helping Ukraine against Russia. So they were going to send weapons and even troops to Ukraine to fight on Ukrainian side. Of course, South Korean laws prohibit this, and South Korean opposition, as well as an overwhelming 82% of the South Korean public, are dead against getting any involvement in Ukraine. So, how do you solve that problem? You solve it by orchestrating a coup, implementing a blanket censorship, arresting, and we now know that they were going to kill the leadership of the opposition Democratic Party. And so this is all related, but the coup fell. The coup failed for now. I think that the Chinese are obviously completely aware of all these events. They understand what's going on. They're not going to turn away from this alliance for any reason because it's absolutely existential. In the same way that once the Western powers overthrew Ukrainian government, and then over the space of the next 8 years, weaponized Ukraine against Russia, in the very same way, if they managed, for example, to regime change Russia, then they would weaponize Russia against China. They don't fight their own wars. They just manipulate a whole society into fighting for them as a proxy force. So they want to destroy Russia, they want to regime change it, and they want to partition it into 5 or 25 smaller, weaker political entities. So they go to Ukraine, they change the government there, they bring NATO, they arm Ukraine, they tripled the size of Ukrainian military between 2014 and 2022. And then they provoke Russia into invading. The same exact scenario could be orchestrated against China if they somehow manage to overthrow the government in Russia. So the Chinese know that they have to be allied with Russia to the bitter end until the West has been finally defeated and the Eurasian continent pacified. And so they will remain committed to this strategy, to this agenda, no matter what. Tariffs, trade sanctions, all these things, it's small potatoes. It's never going to change their long-term strategy and their geopolitical commitments. And I think that the same is true about the Iranians. And so everything that we've seen happening now is only going to strengthen their alliance and their determination to prevail in this fight.
How do you see Turkey right now? Yesterday, we've learned that there is a new contract between Iran and Turkey, $20 billion. And Russia doesn't seem to walk away from Turkey.
Nima, I was very perplexed because I thought that either Turkey, meaning Turkish intelligence, maybe Erdogan himself, they are in on this big trap in Syria. It's not inconceivable. Or the Russians and the Iranians duped Erdogan into this knee-jerk attack on Syria, because apparently, there were these talks going on between Bashar al-Assad and the Arab states, about normalizing relationships with the Western powers, easing of sanctions in order for Bashar al-Assad to distance himself from Hezbollah and Iran. And so this information about these talks was briefed to Erdogan, apparently. And Erdogan maybe panicked because this was going to cross his line with respect to an independent Kurdistan potentially on his doorstep. And so that's why he hastily launched this attack from Idlib at Syria. The other possibility is that he knew about this and he launched this in cahoots with the Russians and with the Iranians. Now, here's why I think that if I had to bet money, I would bet that he was in cahoots with them, that they coordinated this. For a very long time, Turkey has been treated like a second fiddle by NATO and by the European Union. They were being strung along with these interminable discussions about whether, you know, Turkey would be able to bring join the European Union or not. This is, you know, the Europeans use this as a lure with all these nations. You know, they've been stringing along the Ukrainians for 24 years. Like, okay, we're going to let you into the EU, but not quite yet. You know, you're not ready. You have to do these reforms and so on. And I think that the Turks got fed up. And at the same time, you know, Erdogan has been asking for membership in the BRICS countries. He, in the presence of Xi Jinping at the last SCO summit, he was explicitly saying that that Turkey sees their future with the Eurasian integrations, that they are looking to expand their cooperation with the SCO. SCO has been increasingly, you know, it's not a military alliance, but they've been actually looking to put together a more forceful response to these Western-sponsored extremist and separatist and terrorist organizations throughout the Eurasian continent and to neutralize them. So, you know, it's starting to get military dimensions as well. And then, you know, the Chinese responded by increasing their investments into Turkey. So, you know, we saw that Alibaba is bringing, is investing about $2 billion into Turkey, that BYD, the car manufacturer, is building a $1 billion plant in Western Turkey. The Russians are completing a large nuclear power plant and have a program for training up Turkish engineers in running this plant. And not to forget that Russia has designated Turkey as a major natural gas hub for the Western markets. So this puts Turkey into a very powerful position. When the attack from Idlib happened, it was strangely hush-hush. They were not... They didn't launch into this, the Turks betrayed us and now everything is over and we're not going to talk to Erdogan anymore. They kept it quite silent, which was very, in fact, it was quite strange. And now, you know, what you bring up, I think, is another bit of evidence that probably this was done together. You know, the United States has tried to, well, you know, CIA and MI6, they already tried to overthrow Erdogan in 2016. They would have assassinated him, you know. And so he has no reason to trust them, you know. Also, they are the losing side in this war. They've, you know, the West has already been strategically defeated. So, to my mind, it doesn't really make sense that Erdogan would stab the Russians and the Iranians in the back and break the bridges with China in order to throw his lot with the Western powers who tried to overthrow him in 2016, who are constantly threatening to destabilize Turkey with, you know, with the by through the proxy force in Kurdistan, and then not to mention, you know, Greece, which is another proxy on the leash of the Western powers, which can, you know, become another crisis flashpoint for Turkey any day. So, you know, unless there was this irrational obsession with the Ottoman possessions from history, you know, Aleppo and Antioch and other places, and this ambition to consolidate the great Turania under Erdogan's leadership or something like this, then I would bet my money that Erdogan was in on it and that they are working together, and that that then again contributes to the idea that Syria was a trap that was sprung for the West and that is going to be the final lethal quagmire for the Western Empire.
Alex, right now we have some sort of military cooperation between Iran, Russia, and China. Just assuming Turkey joining this alliance, some sort of relationship. And the question is right now, Alex, do you think that in the future, in order to make some sort of peace all over the world, just making some sort of balance of power, some sort of equilibrium, does BRICS need to put out, not just, they're talking about their military cooperations, but just putting out that they're going to have an army keeping each and every country within BRICS safe from what's coming from the outside? That would be a huge change, in my opinion, because they have to talk about it. It's not just you have some sort of potential, like Oreshnik. Russia was talking about, we're going to respond. Nobody, Russia is nothing. They're not going to do anything until they have learned that Russia has the capabilities to respond without going nuclear. I think BRICS needs that moment to show the West that they're going to have a solid response from BRICS if they're going to attack any of members.
Yes, I entirely agreed. And then, you know, by the way, there was a massive missile attack by Russia on Ukraine just today, which was, you know, planned. I had a chat with Larry Johnson yesterday, and I told him that this was coming because I had it. I had the information from another person who is briefed and who is in contact with the Russian command. I don't know whether BRICS as such needs to have their military, their own NATO. I see that the Russians are establishing various forms of military cooperation with strategic countries around the world, like Venezuela, like Cuba, like the African countries, Niger, Burkina Faso, and so forth. And they are, you know, they send these Wagner units there to reinforce and help the local militaries. I think, you know, they will continue to do that to make sure that these countries are no longer vulnerable to, you know, the U.S., carrier strike groups and rapidly deployed special forces, the, you know, British SAS, you know, these people that come basically to wreak havoc, assassinate, you know, run assassinations and these basically sabotage operations, so that they are, you know, that they have intelligence support, that they have, that they're organized well enough to rapidly respond to any threats. And I think over time, they will probably be able to equip them with other forms of weaponry that are going to be able to keep Western forces at a distance. I think that today we see that a version of that in Yemen, because Yemen has demonstrated a capability to to accurately strike not only at Israel, but also at U.S. Maritime forces in the region. And we saw that the Americans had no choice but to withdraw their carrier strike groups outside of the range of their rockets. But, you know, Iran has those rockets. Yemen has those rockets. The West has no answers to this. They've been running this Prosperity Guardian operation now for about a year and a half or even longer, and they haven't been able to subdue the Yemenis. And so I think that the BRICS alliance in one way or another are going to be growing teeth and defensive capabilities. Is it going to be some kind of a centrally administered military like a NATO or not? I would suspect that probably not. But other forms of military cooperation are certainly going to be cultivated and expanded over the years.
Because NATO, the attitude of NATO is expanding, just going, putting the, especially the United States arms in other countries, because they're not producing these weapons in Europe, in Germany, and mostly from the United States. They're putting them. Yes. They know how they work. They know how to gather the information for those equipments. But when you talk about BRICS, people are afraid of NATO. That's why they're joining BRICS. They're afraid of G7. That's why they're joining BRICS. The nature is totally different.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. You see, the part of NATO's problem is that it's the expansion is driven also by money. I'm from Croatia, and Croatia joined NATO, I think, in 2006. And one of the things that NATO did before Croatia was able to join is we had to dismantle our heavy weapons industries. Croatia was producing T-80 or T-84 tanks domestically. And these are excellent tanks. You know, they are based on the Russian, you know, models, but much more advanced. And there was a great, and then we had our own domestically produced howitzers and whatnot, anti-aircraft guns. We had to dismantle all that. Why? Because then we had to buy those things from the NATO producers, i.e., American military-industrial complex. So, you know, that was brilliant for them. Then they push you to spend 2% of your GDP as a NATO member country. So all of this money, which is massive amounts of money, end up flowing predominantly to the American, but also French and British and German military-industrial complex. Well, the only thing is that all of these weapons are produced for profit making, whereas on Russian, Iranian, Chinese side, there's no such concern. They're made for the use, for the purpose. So there, the military people ask themselves, what do we need to defend ourselves and to prevail in a large-scale war? And then they decide we need these things. And then they produce those things and try to produce the best, most robust, most durable and reliable tools and weapons that they can. In the West, they like to produce things that look good in brochures and in those slick presentations, you know, when they do the light show and they introduce F-35, and then they have music and effects and speakers, and they list all the phenomenal capabilities of these systems, but they don't really integrate with everything else. So NATO finds itself very weak. And then they produce just enough for them to, you know, make it look fancy, but they don't have sufficient capabilities to endure an extended engagement with a serious adversary, which is why the West ended up almost completely disarming themselves in this conflict with Russia and Ukraine and in with Israel. And now they had to stage a coup in South Korea to be able to tap South Korean stockpiles of weapons, because they're the only one that have still large stockpiles of 155 millimeter shells and 105 millimeter rounds and even Taurus missiles. The whole Western model, security architecture, defense model is it's obsolete, it's rife with corruption, and it's ineffective. And so obviously, Russia, China, India, Iran, BRICS nations are looking for different models and a completely different security architecture. And I think that this is what's being done today.
Alex, when you look at this excitement in the West, in those people who are in favor of, who are supporting Israel and the United States and their policies in that region, do you think that with what has happened in Syria, is that going to change the reality of what has happened in southern Lebanon, which Israel was defeated by Hezbollah? Israel couldn't achieve anything in Gaza. They couldn't remove Hamas from Gaza. Houthis are still there in Yemen. They can hit Israel anytime they want to attack them. And right now, with Iran, it doesn't matter for Iran. The capabilities of Iran are still there. They can hit Israel anytime they want.
Yes.
And on the other hand, they have a nuclear bomb on their border. Before that, it was Bashar al-Assad supplying Hezbollah. Right now, it's a nuclear bomb. They don't know when it's going to explode in their face and what would be the outcome of that. It seems that the situation, as you mentioned, is not that simple to just say they have been defeated. They capture everything in that region.
I think that's premature. That's very premature. You know, I think that the land bridge between South Lebanon and Iran has been interrupted, not broken. And I think that it's going to be reestablished in one way or another. I don't see how they could prevent that land bridge from functioning through some form of smuggling by some routes. It's not a fragile thing. Second, you know, yes, okay, if this land bridge is interrupted, then Hezbollah is has a new disadvantage. But you know, let's remember that Hamas, for example, has been fighting the Israelis for how long has it been? 14 months now, without interruption. They don't have that land bridge. So, you know, there's a certain robustness and certain resilience to these organizations that I'm sure that Hezbollah is going to survive this blow, that they're going to regroup and that they're going to reestablish lines of communication and supplies with Iran. And celebrating this as some kind of a victory and pretending that Hezbollah has now imploded on itself is I think it's childish. Things don't work quite that easily in the real life. And so we'll find out, and I think we'll find out fairly soon, because if according to what I hear is that Israel is already trying out south of Lebanon to see how Hezbollah will respond, to see if they were if they're going to withdraw, if they're going to fight, what's going to happen, and then maybe try another run on southern Lebanon. We'll find out. So far they haven't been able to take a single village. We'll see what happens now. But if I were on the Israeli side, I would be extremely, extremely worried and cautious about this. And I would predict that they're not going to have much success against Hezbollah anyway.
Hezbollah is capable of producing their arms on their soil. And I think one of the strategies that Iran can apply, just help them to produce everything in Lebanon. They don't need necessarily Iranian weapons going there. They can produce them. They have the capabilities of doing this. It's Hezbollah. It's not just they didn't invent Hezbollah just yesterday. Hezbollah is a
exactly.
It has everything in Lebanon to do that. That's why I think that would be a game changer. They have to maybe make them more independent from Iran. That would be even better for the future of Lebanon and Hezbollah.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I think that everything that's happened now is only going to harden the West and the Israeli targets there. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to get them defeated. It's not that easy. You know, insurgency only has to survive. We have to remember, Israel is losing not because there was Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Israel is losing because their economy is imploding, because, you know, the state is imploding. Many of the essential services are no longer functioning. They are still vulnerable to missile attacks from Israel, from Iran, and from Yemen. Hezbollah is still there. Hamas hasn't been defeated yet. The political class is in turmoil. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu every so often scores one of these Pyrrhic victories, and then he chest thumps and like, oh, look at us, we're winning, and we're going to win, and Indefeatable? No, that's not the word. We can't be defeated. And then he buys himself another few weeks or another few months of political life. But, you know, longer term, the trajectory is on a downward spiral. And now they have Syria overrun by these jihadi mercenaries. Well, what if Iran offers them more money? Because I guarantee you now, the Iranians and the Russians were immediately on the phone with these people to say, who are you? What do you want? Can we work together? 100%. And they are talking to each other, and they will talk to each other. You know, whoever is overly fanatical there will get destroyed through attrition, through mutual fights and recriminations. And I think that certain proxy forces there will emerge who are going to gravitate towards Iran. Same thing happened in Iraq, hasn't it? And now Iraqi militias are dominated by Iran. They are Iran's proxy forces. I think that there's every likelihood that the same will happen in Syria. We'll find out. You know, it's early days. We have to wait for the dust to settle. There are, you know, many of these Salafist Takfiri fanatics among the HTS forces in Syria. But let's remember, these are small forces. They're, you know, 30,000 people who are mutually hostile to each other is not going to last long. And it's not a foundation on which to build a government for a very complex society. So right now there's a complete political vacuum in Syria, and that political vacuum is going to be filled not by Israelis and not by Americans, but most probably by Iranian proxies.
Alex, do you think the situation in Ukraine is getting to its final point? And maybe, because right now in the United States, it doesn't seem that the Trump administration or the people who are willing to work with Trump are looking for any sort of compromise and cooperation with Russia. They want to just put the terms on the table, and Russia has to accept them. We know that is not the reality of what's going on in Ukraine. Ukrainians are losing. They're trying to reduce the draft age from 25 to 18, which is huge for this population of Ukraine. It's just simply putting an end to the population of Ukraine, to the future of Ukraine. What's your understanding on what's going on in Ukraine right now?
Well, my understanding is that Ukraine is in the final stages of its defeat. And, reducing the draft age to 18 years of age is a is sheer desperation, and it's not going to change the trajectory of the war. You're going to get, if they push this through, they're just going to get a lot of young kids slaughtered on the battlefield. And I hope that Zelensky will persevere in his determination not to lower the draft age. It remains to be seen how the Ukrainian population might react to this, because I think they're not going to take it sitting down. And I think it spells doom for Ukraine, and it's probably not far. It's not far. All this pressure from the West only goes to prove that the Western powers themselves are in a panic that they're going to lose. And I think that in a not too distant future, I think that the Russians will be able to pull forward probably all the way to the Dnieper. The status of Odessa remains to be seen. What's going to happen? And the status of Kiev also, will the Russians leave Kiev are they going to overrun Kiev as well and take control of it? Ultimately, one way or another, whether it's going to be by military conquest or by political conquest, and I think it's going to be the political conquest, Russia is going to take control of all of Ukraine except for the Western side, which is going to end up another European Idlib, where it's going to have these Azovites and Idar people there, neo-proto-fascist, neo-Nazis running the country. And then it's going to probably end up being a big, big problem for Poland, and possibly some other countries in the region. And Europe is also going to have a huge problem with migrants, with the refugees from Ukraine. Russia is probably going to be consolidating its political control over Ukraine. All these Western fantasies that they're going to propose some kind of a ceasefire, some kind of a freezing of this conflict, it's unrealistic. The Russians already won. They have no reason to accept some lousy ceasefire just to please Donald Trump. Donald Trump doesn't have a magic wand with which to reverse anything in Ukraine. He might be able to get on with Vladimir Putin better than anybody in Biden administration did. But, the reality on the ground is that Russia won, and they're not going to give away any part of their winning to please Donald Trump. They have no reason to do that. In the end, I think Trump, we even had the explicit statement about this from Sergei Karaganov. And he said that what Russia is doing now is, he said that our strategy is to find a peaceful way to help the United States transition from being a hegemon to being a normal major power. And I think that it makes sense also for the Americans and for the Trump administration to transition from being an empire to being a normal major power, to make nice with the Russians, with the Chinese, with the Indians, with everybody, and to trade, to develop their economy based on trade with the world, including the BRICS, including the all of these Eurasian powers. To import stuff, export stuff, and to build the prosperity at home rather than wasting themselves by being the world's policeman.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today.
My pleasure always.
Great pleasure as always.
Take care, Niman.
Take care. Bye-bye.